This is the Microsoft Cloud Show, episode 124, where AC and I are going to geek out about space. Recorded live April 11, 2016.
Welcome to the Microsoft Cloud Show, the only place to stay up to date on everything going on in the Microsoft Cloud world, including Windows Azure, Office 365, SharePoint, Exchange, Link, and related technologies. Just the information, no marketing, no BS. I'm Chris Johnson.
And I'm Andrew Cole.
And we're just two dudes telling you how we see it.
The Microsoft Cloud Show is sponsored by Valid.nl. Valid is a Microsoft Gold partner whose mission is to enable its customers to excel in their business through the innovative use of technology. Valid is always on the lookout for consultants, architects, and engineers. Do you know Azure, BI, and Analytics, .NET, Office 365, or SharePoint? Look them up on Valid.nl. How's it going?
It's going awesome, man. I've been looking forward to this one.
Who's having a little nerdgasm at the other end?
Oh my God, I'm still on a high. I guess, well, yeah, this will be fun. This is not just a space geek out, but I know our friends probably saw us light up Twitter in the last 2 weeks about it, but there's a lot more kind of stuff that we get to share with this one. So this will be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think it's probably worth mentioning that for our regular listeners, this is not an ordinary show. We are not going to talk about much cloud computing. We're not going to talk about Azure. We're not going to talk about Office 365 very much. What we are going to talk about is
beyond the clouds.
take a moment to geek out about our recent visits to the Kennedy Space Center on two different trips that we went as part of a NASA social event that they put on for two different launches in fairly quick succession. So turn us off if you're not interested in that, I guess. It's probably a great way to put it. Skip this show. We'll be back to regular programming soon. But we just thought we'd try this out. We'd love to hear if you're interested in hearing more of these things. We won't do them if you're not. So definitely let us know on how you feel about us geeking out about particular deep dive topics that don't necessarily have to do with the Microsoft Cloud per se. But don't worry, we're not going to do this every week. This is kind of a one-off thing for the meantime.
Yeah, we've only done one of these in the past where we talked about Node.js, but we got a lot of really good reaction to it. But at least I think that this geek out does kind of have an overlap with a lot of our listeners. It's hard to find people who do the kind of work that we do and have zero interest at all in this. And so it does kind of time nicely because there was a bit of very big space related news in the last week since we've published the show, where SpaceX was able to now successfully, on their fifth attempt, was able to successfully land and stick the landing, the first stage of their Falcon 9 rocket on a platform on the drone ship out in the Atlantic Ocean. They landed one back in December of 2015, but early April of 2016, they now have landed one on the ship. So it's a bit of current events kind of stuff too, but it also coincides with two things that CJ and I did. So we did this thing.
Yeah, why don't you explain a little bit about what we went and did, and I guess it's worth pointing out, we didn't do this together either. So you went on a trip and I went on a trip independently, but we're going to talk about them as almost like the experience as if it was one thing, because they sound very similar, but they were two different launch events. So
yeah, so there are two different launch events. We each did a lot of the same stuff and we each had some unique experiences that we'll share. So what NASA does, first of all, let me just clarify that this is a free thing. This is open to anybody. There are some requirements around it, but there's nothing special about how CG and I got into this. But we did do two individual ones, although I think that we would both like to do this together as well one day, because I can't wait to do this again already. So what NASA does is that they're on a shoestring budget for lots of stuff, including their social media presence. And so they have a small group of people that their full-time job is around something called NASA Social. So they're on Twitter at NASA Social. They're on Instagram. I think they're on Facebook. For mine, it was cool because they debuted on Periscope and Snapchat as well for the one that I did. But essentially what they do is that they put something out as a press release, and it's a social media thing that basically says that they will take up to 50 people who can apply to be accepted into this. You supply all transportation, you supply your food, all that stuff. They just say, come to us. We want to show you some really cool stuff and give you a ton of information. You're up for doing the rest of it, covering your cost to get there. And the reason they do this, or at least I'm going to hypothesize on why they do this, is that because NASA is on such a shoestring budget, and because they are trying to get the word out about what they're doing, this is a great way to do it. You invite 50 people who are in the media, who are enthusiasts or whatever. The only two requirements are is that number one, is that they have, they're over 18 years old, and they have a social media presence because they don't want people coming who are like, if you're not on any social media, they're not going to pick you because you're essentially their free force multiplier for getting stuff out into the social media.
There's also one more thing for those foreign listeners. You have to either be a US citizen or you have to be a US permanent resident to apply as well. So you've either got to be a green card holder or a US citizen. And I think that's for security reasons and background checks and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. And so what they do is they invite you to come out, and it's generally centered around some sort of a special event. This is the eighth one that they've done. I went on the eighth one. You went on the seventh one. For both of us, it's centered around a launch. And so you show up, and let's say the launch is on a Tuesday. You show up Monday, you go through a bunch of tours, a bunch of briefings, ability to see a bunch of different things. And then on the day of the launch, it's more of the same, but you also get to go out to the launch pad, and then you get to watch the launch and potentially go to the post-mission briefing.
Yeah.
So which one did you do? Why don't you tell us a little bit about which one you did? And I'll explain what I did. And then we'll go through the whole agenda, but let's say context around when we saw it.
Yeah, so the different launches. Mine was a few weeks ago now, but it was for the launch of the Orbital ATK Cygnus mission to ISS, which was a cargo resupply mission to the International Space Station. And Cygnus is the cargo ship, is the spaceship, so to speak. But it launched on a United Launch Alliance, or a ULA, Atlas rocket from Kennedy Space Center. So it was taking the Cygnus up into orbit, and then Cygnus flies up to ISS on a cargo resupply, and they get fresh fruit and bits and pieces and a bunch of experiments as well, obviously, lots of science. And that was launched by Orbital ATK and ULA in collaboration with one another.
Yeah, mine was, I was there, I think it was April 7th and 8th or 8th and 9th. I can't remember which one it was, but when I was there, it was SpaceX. It was a SpaceX launch. It was CRS-8, which is the commercial resupply mission number 8, where we were there. SpaceX was sending up their Dragon capsule filled with a bunch of stuff up to the space station. I'll talk about some of the stuff that they put up there. It's the first time SpaceX has attempted to go back to the space station since the rocket that they lost in mid-2015 when CRS-7 blew up and they lost a lot of. Or CRS-6, I'm not sure which one it was, but when it blew up and they lost the entire cargo.
Must have been 7, because the Orbital ATK launch was CRS-6.
That's right. What was disappointing about that one, too, is that the capsule, so the SpaceX rocket is in basically two pieces. Falcon 9 is the actual first stage rocket, and then the payload is the Dragon capsule. And what was disappointing about the one they lost last time was that when the rocket blew up, Dragon wasn't affected, but because Dragon had no way to go to the space station the rest of the way, it just kind of flew out and then hit the ocean and then sank to the bottom of the ocean with all the supplies, including two Microsoft HoloLenses.
Oh, brutal.
So they lost a lot of experiments and stuff, but it was cool. The day before my launch, they actually released news that they added a parachute system to the Dragon so that if they did lose it, a parachute would go and it would float down to the Atlantic and they can go out and recover the payload.
Oh, nice. So we signed up for these things. You apply online. You can watch the NASA social tweet stream for when they're looking for people to go. And so we both applied, and I sort of did it on a bit of a whim, thinking, oh, there's no way I'll get picked for this, right? And I got an email in my inbox and it was like, hey, if you're interested, fill out this form and apply to go on the social event. And I was like, okay. And so I went ahead and filled out the form, and there's a bunch of questions in there, and fill it all out and submit it, and thinking, chances are I'm not going to get this. And then a few days later, boom, you've been accepted pending security clearance. And so then I was like, oh, great, here comes the foreigner card. I'm so close. But sure enough, I'm a permanent resident here in the States, so apparently I'm not too dodgy, and they let me in. Which was awesome. So I bought tickets to Florida, booked my hotel, all that sort of stuff before I got security clearance, because this was all in the last 5 days before the launch. So technically I wasn't in until I'd already bought all these non-refundable tickets. But I was like, come on, I'm sure this is going to happen, let's roll. And so I got accepted, and in my case, I flew down to Florida, but you just drove down from your place, right, in Jacksonville?
Kind of, yeah.
Sort of, yeah.
You went via a few other places, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
In a nutshell.
It was pretty cool. I had never heard about this. And then I saw you post something about it, and it, like, my eyes got as big as saucers. Like, oh my God, I want to go. I ended up being out of town when you did this. But then when, like, almost immediately after yours happened, you saw it posted again, that they posted another social for the SpaceX mission. And I had like 48 hours to apply. So they open it up and they announce it. For me, they announced it on March the 18th. And I had to have my application in by the 21st, which, I mean, that it doesn't take long at all to actually put your application in.
The window is pretty short because they got to know what date the launch is going to happen on. Yeah, not obviously guaranteed, but they can't really center a social event around a launch maybe happening. So I
applied for mine, and same thing. I got my acceptance, but I had the fun challenges that I was at a conference last week when we recorded the last podcast. I was out in Las Vegas for a startup, bootstrap, small business kind of conference. And I was scheduled to fly back to Jacksonville, where I live, and land at like 11:30 at night on a Wednesday. And then I had to be at Cape Canaveral at the press accreditation office at 7 a.m. the next morning, which is about 3 hours away from my house. So I'm like, oh, I got to land at 11:30 at night and then drive 3 hours, crash in a hotel for about 2 or 3 hours, and then get up and go be on my feet all day. So thankfully, I was able to change that flight and get in a heck of a lot earlier. But yeah, so you get there and you go through you get your badged up, and then we meet each day. Both days we met at the press accreditation office. Security comes out with a bomb sniffing dog and checks all the bags, and then you're not allowed to go back to your cars, and you jump on a bus, and then they start taking you all around.
Yeah, it's a jam-packed action-packed and jam-packed couple of days. So should we dive into roughly what the 2 days entail or what we saw?
Absolutely, yeah. So I'll start with mine, because I know we had similar but not exactly the same experiences, which was kind of cool. But we both did luck out the fact that our launches went on the first try, no scrub. So that's really lucky.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So my day started with, you go through a little, everyone goes in and introduces themselves, announce themselves. I had some really interesting people on mine. I had the guy in charge of social media for Product Hunt, people in charge of social for Flipboard, the guy from AccuWeather who's in charge of all space weather for AccuWeather, and a bunch of other really great people that made some really good friends. But I went straight to the Neil Armstrong building and into the high bays and got to see them working on the Orion capsule, which is the next capsule that is essentially the successor to the Apollo mission. But it's the capsule that is going to be used. It's going to be launched on top of the Space Launch System, or the SLS rocket, in late 2018, unmanned, and fly around the moon in a 40,000 mile orbit, which is farther out than any manned craft has been. And I think the goal is to actually send it up with people around the moon in, I believe it's supposed to happen in 2021 is when it's planned, but we got to see them work on it. They flew this Orion capsule back in 2014, in December of 14. And right now what they're doing is they have the thing that goes on the inside that maintains the atmosphere and the pressure for the astronauts that are in there. It's a flimsy kind of structure that can't sustain the vertical upward velocity of launch, nor can it sustain if there was an abort and the top part ripped off the top of the SLS and took the capsule with it. It can't sustain that. So they were in the middle of taking the atmosphere and putting it inside of a shell inside of a structure that amounts to Orion. So we saw them build the wiring harnesses and drilling holes in it for the wiring harnesses, and saw where they're going to do the pressure test to check the welds and all that stuff. That was really cool getting up close to Orion.
That's really cool. Yeah, I think we kicked off our first couple of days again with the bomb sniffing dogs, both starting at like 7 o'clock in the morning. And after you've flown from the other side of the country, I was lagging. Let me tell you, lagging. But of course, the adrenaline kicked in, so got off to a good start. So we kicked off our first couple of days with a pad visit. So we went out to pad 39A and B, where the space shuttles used to launch from, and went out to visit the new SpaceX facility. We didn't go in, but just passed it. 39A, they've rented from, they're leasing it from NASA. And so making a whole lot of modifications to pad 39A, and they've built a new building out there and things. So that was kind of cool. It was just phenomenal to think all through these 2 days, the history that exists at the Kennedy Space Center. The Saturn Vs took, and the Apollo missions took astronauts to the moon from these pads, and it just makes me, it made me shudder thinking about all the history at places like that. Pad 39B has been modified since the space shuttle days, and they're getting ready for the SLS launches in a few years' time. So that's that was really exciting. Saw that that had been modified, and then we went down to the beach out near where the beach house that the astronauts hang out at before the launches. So we got to drive down that part of the beach, and then down to where the ULA launch facility is, and a quick look at the launch pad there. We came back to it on day two to watch the rollout, or sorry, see the rocket after rollout, and get up close and personal with it. But that's how we kicked off our first day. It was a bit of a cruise around the various launch pads. And then we went to the next big thing, I guess, was we went on a VAB, so the Vehicle Assembly Building tour. And this is an unfathomably large building, like... But you could fit a 40-story building inside this building, and it's where they stacked the Saturn Vs, where they stacked the space shuttle, basically where they built a whole lot of vertically assembled buildings. Vertically assembled rockets.
Yeah.
Which NASA is known for. Before they get rolled out to the launch pad, it is humongous, and it's kind of one of those things that you go inside and you look at and you're like, man, this makes no sense to my brain because this place is gigantic and everything is huge, but the scale is all relative. So it's like, it scrambled my brain a bit.
It did the same with me. So we visited the VAB on day two. So the building itself is, I think it's 40 stories. It's 556 feet high. And you really, I mean, all the pictures I took, every time I looked at a picture, it's like, it just doesn't do any justice. You don't have any kind of scale. And even with, like you said, when you're on the ground with your eyes, you look up and it's just, you can't understand how big it really is. What was interesting to me, and I didn't realize it, is how the building is organized. And so it's got something called a low bays and high, or one low bay and then four high bays. When you look at the VAB, it used to be the biggest building in the world. It still is volume wise, but it's not in terms of height wise. But essentially what it, and also for some perspective, you could fit Yankee Stadium in New York City on top of the VAB, and you see the US flag on the side. The width of that is the width of a city bus. So that's how big those things are.
Each of the stripes on the flag is the width of a city bus.
Correct. Sorry. Thank you. Each of the stripes. So you could fit, what is that? Like maybe 10 buses like side by side. And that's only a quarter of the damn thing. But when you look at the low bays, what happens is think about going into the front door. That's going into the low bays. And so that's where the shuttle would be dragged in, or the external fuel tank or the boosters or any other rocket parts would be dragged in that way. And then what they would do is they go to the back of the building, and they would have a crane. They had three cranes in there, and one of them would grab a hold of whatever it is and would lift it up. Now, 16 floors inside that building, there's like a walkway that kind of goes around. The building is kind of broken up into two sections of a lower half and an upper half. And what they would do to get something into the high bays is they would grab a hold of it with the crane. They would lift it up, and they'd have to lift up over that 16th floor, like, gantryway, and then lower it back down. So pictures you may have seen of the shuttle being what they call is being stacked, you would see the external fuel tank and two boosters, and then you would see the shuttle hovering way above it being lowered down. That's because it was lifted up over that 16th floor and brought down.
Yeah, I went and walked across that 16th floor gantry or walkway.
I thought that was high.
Yeah, me too. And you know, you go up in the elevator, you get out, and you're like, and you look up, and it still seems really tall above you. And it's because there's like more than 20 stories more to go. And then you look down, and you're like, wow, I'm 16 stories up, and this building is still gigantic above me.
Yeah. Now, is that as high as you went?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Okay. So then I haven't told you about that. We've talked offline, but man, I got something else to share with you then. So we got at 16. You walk across this little, it's really like a very narrow little area. Like you could, if you imagine standing there and kind of opening your arms up to where your elbows are out, like the width of you, less than like 6 feet wide. When you walk across, you don't have a ton of room. And you just as a fence going up both sides, you can kind of look down so you can see how big of a fall it is. Well, we jumped on another elevator, and that took us up to the 34th floor. So twice, even over twice as high as that. And you went across a walkway that was maybe 3.5-4 feet wide. Now, granted, you were in a fence, so you weren't going to fall, but the walkway kind of moves because it's so high up. And I look down, and I'm not afraid of heights, but no one told my head that I'm not afraid of heights. And so my brain just gets a little scramble when I see it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It looked like there was a fire truck that was inside, and it looked like a toy.
Yeah. That's crazy high.
I had to look straight ahead. But the cool part was we walked across the main gap on the 34th floor, jumped on a third elevator that took us up to the roof, and we got to go outside on the roof of this building.
That is so cool.
Had a railing about 10 feet back, but man, it was nuts. You could see, it was absolutely gorgeous. I took a ton of pictures, put them on a Flickr album, and I'll put that in the show notes. But you can see the pictures from us on the VAB. That was just, it was epic. Absolutely epic.
Nice. So VAB is just, I thought I was totally mind blown by the size and the scale of these operations. They've been spending a ton of time getting it ready for the SLS system, modifying it from the shuttle days and moving it to the configuration required for the SLS. And
still have some of the old braces from Apollo too.
Yeah, exactly. There's still a lot of Apollo hardware in there. But the interesting thing I thought was, like, you looked at the size of the shuttle and you're like, wow, that's a big spacecraft, right? Then you look at the size of the VAB and you're like, wow, the shuttle's really small.
It's only half the size, right?
It's only half up. Yeah, it's only like half the height of the VAB. And then you look at where SLS is going to come up to in that building. Man, that is going to be a gigantic rocket.
Yeah.
It's going to be huge.
So if SpaceX fans, you've heard of something called the BFR, right?
No.
You haven't heard of the BFR?
No, what's a BFR?
All right, so SpaceX right now, they have the Falcon 9. And then later, SpaceX says later this year, but everyone expects it to be January, they have another rocket they're going to put the Heavy, which is basically taking three Falcon 9s, strapping them together.
Yeah.
Well, the next rocket, Elon's called it the BFR, which is a much bigger rocket. No one really said what it stands for, but everyone recognizes it. We're going to bleep.
It's the big effing rocket.
It's the big effing rocket, yeah. So SpaceX actually reached out to one of the engineers that was talking to us. He's like, yeah, we shared them with them our plans because they need to have a place to be able to stack this thing. And we're like, you know, how are you guys going to build it? And they're like, well, we need a really big building to stack the rocket. And so they're like, well, here's the schematic for the VAB. You guys are going to build something like this. And we asked him, we're like, going, would it fit in here? And he goes, it would fit in the VAB by about 4 or 5 feet.
That's it. Yeah. It's a tight squeeze.
Yeah. So we said that. And then one guy, I'm turning around and telling somebody else that. And he's like, no, don't repeat that. I'm like, well, I'm not going to tell you who our engineer was. But yes, that's.
That's awesome. So yeah, that was the VAB tour. Then we went and talked about science. So we went back to the press briefing center area. Annex building and talked about payloads. You know, got different folks talking about the things that were on board. And so this was a Cygnus cargo resupply mission. So there was a bunch of things on board. A couple of things that really piqued my interest. They had these things called gecko grippers on board, which are designed to grip onto things, much like Velcro, to grab hold of things. But without any sticky substances. So the reason they're called gecko grippers is because they're modeled after gecko's feet, and they use van der Waals forces to do so. It's a pad. They're these grippers, pads on the end of them, and they use a spring-loaded force. When you spring on to something and hold on to them, and it's pushing in different directions, it's grippy. But then if you pull them the other direction, they let go. But there's no sticky residue. There's nothing like that. It's all just using these van der Waals forces. So you go look them up, gecko grippers, they're pretty sweet. So that was one of them. They're going to use them for robots on the outside of the ISS to crawl around and make repairs and stuff like that. And they can cling on to smooth surfaces without using adhesive or anything like that. There's no magnetism, you know, like you don't have big magnets, you like cluck, 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 or suction cups or anything weird like that. It's all these gecko grippers. Anyway, so that was one of them. The other one was they set up a payload to do set fire in space. So,
oh yeah,
there have been a couple of experiments already, and there have been a couple of unfortunate experiments. There was a very famous case of a fire on the Mir space station, which came very close to a complete disaster. But fire burns differently in space, more like a ball, like a three-dimensional fire, like a three-dimensional ball of fire, which is really hard to put out. And heat radiates in every direction, so it's fascinating. But anyway, so they set up a payload in the Cygnus spacecraft that when the Cygnus leaves ISS, it's going to burn some material and they're going to study that material burning in space. That was a really interesting experiment. There were some other experiments on board about how sediment particles and earth and things like that settle in microgravity that were also on board along with a whole bunch of cargo for the crew and all that sort of stuff. So there were a bunch of really interesting things on board. And so we got to hear from all the different scientists responsible for those experiments and ask questions about it. That was actually broadcast on NASA TV. So if anybody's interested, you can go up to the NASA TV site and check out all these old recordings that were made. and broadcast about the science that goes up in these missions.
When I went down for this, I was expecting this to be all about rockets and launch and ground control and all the equipment they use. It was actually a bit of a surprise to me when I heard from when you mentioned this. It stood out to me that you did a science briefing, but it really did stand out to me. There are two things that really stood out to me about this entire visit I had. Number one is how prevalent science was in the entire 2-day experience. And I'll come back to that in just a second. But the other one that I thought that was front and center, by far the most central theme of the entire thing, is how so many different groups at NASA across the board, they are singularly focused on getting to Mars. Everybody talked about it.
It was very apparent, yeah.
That surprised.
They seem to be doing now is part of a stepping stone to get to Mars.
Exactly. It's almost like they've said, okay, this whole idea of like doing ISS and resupply missions and crew, we're going to load this off to private industry and we're going to take care of going to Mars, which is cool. So my science briefing was on the first day. It was right after we saw Orion, and it was really interesting. So we had a guy named Trent Smith that came in. He talked about food on board and how they grew lettuce. Now they grew flowers and mm-hmm. all the different challenges around that, and how they wanted to make sure that when they grew stuff, they're going to need to grow their own food, and they need to grow stuff that doesn't have to be cooked, because you can't put a microwave on ISS because of how big it would be with all the shielding to protect everything around it. Mm. So they need stuff that's like pick and eat. So lettuce is good. They made some flowers. They're going to do things like radishes, white potatoes, tomatoes. Those are things that are going in the future. But the idea is that they had to be able to grow these things, and they want to grow them in microgravity. So they didn't want them to start growing or germinating while they were on the ground after they've been packed up. Mm. And they were showing us these little plant pillows that they had created that is just in substrate. And how you give it fertilizer and water and stuff without it going everywhere, but also not using like dirt that we have here at Earth, because that's organic with materials and that would cause it to start germinating. So you have to find this certain kind of dirt that is like quote unquote dead dirt that has no life characteristics to it, so that when they got to the space station, they could start growing these things when they wanted to. That was really interesting. We had another guy come in from a group called NanoRacks, which is, you can look this up online. It was Carload, whose Twitter handle is the Payload Wrangler. So what was interesting...
Payload Wrangler?
Yeah, twitter.com/Payload Wrangler. So Carl was a riot. But what was interesting about this is that this company has come up with something, this NanoRack system, just like we have like servers at home on Earth, where you have like 1U, 2U, 4U type servers in a standardized rack. These guys have created a rack, and I took pictures of this in my Flickr album, but they've created this little like modular system that has imagine like a shoebox, and down the middle of the shoebox is this rail that you can plug USB 2 things into to get data or send data and get power. And then you could buy a 1U, a 2U, or a 4U block and put your science experiment in there. And it goes in this like rack up in ISS. And there was a video of Scott Kelly pulling out the rack and turning on one or two experiments or plugging them in to get them going, putting it back in, and then he would take it back out, pop it off and stick it in one of the resupply mission capsules that went back to Earth, so that you could, it depended if you didn't need it to come back, you just needed the data, they would just transmit the data back. Or if you need the stuff coming back, they would do it. And the way that they did this is that we then had, and there's another system, they have a V2 rack, then there's a V3 rack, and they also have one that goes outside the space station as well. And they showed videos of shooting things out of this thing for experiments that are like the size of a loaf of bread. This one was really neat. This was funded 90% by investors, only 10% by NASA. So I thought that was really cool. If you had an experiment that you wanted to put in there, you and I could come up with an idea and put it in there. So much so that the big news about this one was that there's a 17-year-old high school senior named Anna Sophia from somewhere up in New York who came up with her own science experiment that she designed to check on gene sequencing for the autoimmune system that she designed. She put it up there and it was sent up to the space station on the Dragon capsule.
Wow.
It was awesome. And then Eli Lilly was showing one about how they're trying to build crystals for drug research and to shorten the cycle, where you building a crystal takes a certain amount of time here on Earth and gravity, but they think that it can be significant. They can build bigger crystals significantly faster in microgravity. And so he was showing us the device that they're going to use to start the creation of crystals. And when they start it, they're going to do the same thing on ground so they can see how big they are. What they'll do is they will be sending these crystal things up to the space station, turning them on, building the crystals. And next time a resupply mission comes back, they'll put it back in the capsule and harvest all their larger crystals for future use.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
These guys can also launch microsatellites too, right? So they've got, I think they've had experiments up there for a while where they've got a rack on the outside and they'll start shooting them out into space. So
He showed that one. I have a picture of that in my album of the one that he showed doing that. But the other part that's interesting about this is that the big news around this mission in terms of the payload is something called Beam. And what Beam is imagine something about the size of like a 3-foot by 3-foot cylinder cubish kind of thing. And what that is it's an inflatable habitat that once it inflates, it grows to be 560 cubic feet of space inside. The walls get hard and it's about like 9 feet by 10 feet.
So on that, right, it goes up in Dragon.
Mm-hmm.
And then how do they get it outside and attached to the space station? Did they go into any of those details?
Yes. So what they're going to do is this is supposed to happen on April the 15th. They start unpacking, I think, the Dragon capsule. So we're recording this on Monday, April the 11th. They docked yesterday, April the 10th. And I believe they start unpacking it on April the 12th. So by the time the show comes out. So they're going to take that thing out. They're going to stick it in an airlock. Astronauts going to do a spacewalk to take it outside and attach it to the Canada arm. And then the Canada arm is going to attach it to the other side of the space station. And then somewhere in the latter third of April is when they're going to inflate it to see how it performs.
What sort of confused me is it's like, trying to get a manhole cover through a hole, right?
Mm.
They're kind of round for a reason. And I was like, so this thing has got an airlock on one end of it, like a door on one end of it, but yet it's got to get through the door of Dragon to get out of Dragon and then out of the hole in the space station through the airlock to get outside. So it's like, so they got a round hatch coming through a round hatch, going through another round hatch to get attached to a round hatch.
To the same size round hatch.
To the same size round hatch. So how the hell does that work?
Someone asked that, and the person that was doing the briefing, I'm not so sure she knew because she answered a different question.
Okay.
But it was cool because like the idea around this is that if this works, then they're like, well, what we can do is we can take like 2 or 3 of these things up over the course of 2 or 3 missions. We can put them together. When Dragon comes up, it can actually send it out a little bit farther and it can have like a mini temporary space station on the cheap, put a bunch of experiments in this thing, let them go. And then another mission, Dragon flies up, not the space station this time, but flies up to Beam, harvests all the missions, put new experiments in there and brings them home.
Oh, that's ridiculous. That's so cool.
Isn't that awesome?
It's like a little mini space station. Yeah. I guess it's kind of like Skylab, right? Like Skylab was a space station made out of old rocket parts, strangely enough, like old stages of unused, of course, but stages of Saturn rockets. So yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, it was really cool. And the last part of the briefing, which actually happened on the second day, was we actually had a really cool QA session with the Kennedy Space Center director, Robert Cabana, who's a former astronaut.
Yeah, yeah.
He came in. I thought that I asked him. I said, "What are you most looking forward to?" And he said he's most looking forward to the 2 commercial crew test flights that are happening next year, one with Boeing CTS and one with the Dragon crew capsule.
Mm.
And then the other thing that he can't wait, he says that the thing that keeps him up at night with excitement is he can't wait to see the stacking of SLS and then the ultimate launch with the dummy Orion, which we did see the dummy Orion wrapped up in plastic in the VAB. He can't wait to see that throughout the course of all of 2018.
That's going to be amazing. It's pretty cool to think there are 3 crew capsules in development, right? There's the Boeing Starliner, which is the CST-100. There's the Dragon crew capsule, and there's Orion. So that's kind of like placing bets on 3 things and seeing what pays off. It'll be interesting to see who gets there first and when, and if they all do, right? Like, that'll be interesting.
It's great for the United States, too, because right now we only have one way to get the space station, and that's the Russian Soyuz, which is pretty expensive and very old. But it works. It's very reliable. That's why you keep using it.
Yeah, it's just, I think the only issue with it is relying on the Russians to get you there, right?
Well, that's part of it, too. You don't want to rely on the Russians.
It's very old, but it's extremely well proven, and it's got a great track record.
So the last thing we also had the deputy administrator for NASA, David Newman, come in. She was fun, but dude, the coolest part was we had an astronaut named Doug Wheelock. His on Twitter, it's @astro_wheels. He was a freaking riot. He lived on space station for 6 months.
Wow.
I asked him a little bit about Commander Hatfield and his book and everything. He goes, yeah, you know how he gets all the attention about being on Twitter and taking all those pictures? He's like, yeah. And he goes, go back and look at who the first person was he followed. He sort of pointed himself. He goes, it was me.
That's funny.
Yeah, it was good. It was good. So I'll talk a little bit more about him when we come back to talk about the launch, the pad visits.
Yeah, so the end of day one for me was we went out and saw fabrication of the new crew gantry walkway that the crew will be walking across to get to the new Starliner crew capsule from Boeing. That's being constructed offsite, and it's actually, I think right now it's starting to be transported back to the launch pad for stacking and things like that. But so this is, you know, at the top of a really big rocket, there's a big arm that swings out and attaches to the side of, doesn't attach, but sort of rubs up and next to the side of the rocket, and the crew walk out across that. They usually go into a clean room at the end, which is where they make final preparations for ingress into the vehicle. So that's that thing. So this is the swing arm that goes right out. And it was really cool. We got to meet the guy. There was a guy who will be the operator of that arm. And that was, you know, like, what do you mean operating the arm? Right. So he's the dude responsible for everything that the arm does, the retraction, it back and forth in an emergency, all the things it supplies to the spacecraft and to the crew in the clean room and all that sort of stuff. And on launch day, he's the dude that pushes the button to retract the arm and the operation of that. If it doesn't swing back, obviously, bunch of problems, all that sort of stuff. He was such a cool dude, really nice guy, and took a lot of time to talk to us about, you know, how it's constructed, the safety mechanisms. There's a lot of, like, really obnoxious gases swirling around spacecraft. And so you've got to be really afraid of things like sparks and stuff like that, and fire suppression systems. And it was fascinating. So that was being fabricated offsite. So we went out there and then called it a day.
So we went, I guess the next thing, we didn't get to see that. The next thing we did do was we went out for, on the second day, we went to our launch pad visit. And prior to that, you know, Doug Wheelock, the astronaut, he came with us, or he was giving us a bit of a description about just talking about living on ISS. He was actually the one that pulled Scott Kelly out of the Soyuz when he came back from his 1-year mission.
Oh, right.
And was talking to him. And he's also the one who's responsible for being the first astronaut to fess up about the vision problems. And NASA went and did a bunch of checks. And when other astronauts saw that they were taking care of him and not grounding him, about 20 other astronauts came back and talked to him about the problems that he was having and about how, like, your optic nerve swells and how the pressure in your body, it causes the back of your eye to become flat. And he told us about a bunch of stuff. He's like, we asked him, like, what was the difference? He's been to space station, or he's been up in space 4 times aboard both the Soyuz, up and down in the Soyuz, and up and down in the shuttle. And he's like, it's very different experience. So with the shuttle, he said, when you go up and that first, and the engine's cut off, he says, it's like you're in a freight train that just got rear-ended. He says, it's amazing how, like, you feel like you just got nailed with the amount of force that you're used to, and it just stops. Huh. And then he said, when you're coming home, it's incredibly smooth. He said, when the one time he came home, or it's incredibly smooth, relatively speaking, to Soyuz. He said, when we're coming back in the United States, he said, we crossed over U.S. airspace in Seattle, and then we're doing these banking maneuvers across the United States to slow down. He said, I looked out my window at one point and said, man, what's that lake? That's a big lake. And they're like, that's the Gulf of Mexico. but 19 minutes after crossing over Seattle, they were landing. That's how fast it is.
Yeah, it comes in pretty hot.
Yeah. So he talked about that. He said Soyuz. He said everyone says a Soyuz is really comfortable. He goes, yeah, landing in Soyuz is pretty comfortable. It's kind of like being, it's kind of like going over Niagara Falls in a barrel, but the barrel's also on fire.
Yeah.
So
what is the statement of the century like?
Oh, yeah.
I imagine it is a horrifying experience.
Someone asked him, I said, yeah, they say that landing in Soyuz is a nice soft landing. And he just does air quotes. He goes, if you want to call it a soft landing, he said, you know, those retro rockets that slow you down kick in at about a meter off the ground. He said, we hit the ground, bounced twice, and then rolled to where we're all upside down each other. And he said, it was just, we're all kind of looking.
Welcome home.
Yeah, he goes, but then we're home. He did say there were, I thought there was two things that he said that were really interesting worth saying real quick. One was that the experience of doing a spacewalk, that when you're in the sunlight during the day, it's 300 degrees outside. So you have a cooling system in your spacesuit to keep you cool. But when the sun goes down, so it, you know, sunrise and sunset happens every 45 minutes when you're rotating the Earth every 90 minutes. In the cold, in the shade of the Earth, it plummets down to 300 degrees below zero. So that's a 600 degree Fahrenheit change. And what they would do is they would warn him about 3 minutes before it would go in from sunlight to sunset, because the spacesuit has no heaters on it. It just has a cooling system. So they would turn their cooling system off and try to get the spacesuit as hot as they could tolerate right before it went to cold, because then they had to maintain their body temperature while they were in the shade.
Wow. I didn't know that. I thought it did heating as well.
No heating. It's only cooling.
Wow, that's fascinating.
And we asked him, what was the scariest moment you ever had? And he said it was July 31st, 2010, around 11:30 at night GMT. We're like, wow, what happened?
He remembers it well then.
Yeah. He's like, the pump module failed and they lost half of the lights, power, and life support in the space station. Mm. And he said, when something like that happens, he goes, everybody was elsewhere in the space station. My job was to do one thing, to shut something off. And when I went to do it, all these alarms went off. And he goes, and when that happens, you're trained to have three things go through your head. Number one, am I on fire? He goes, I looked around and I didn't see a fire and I wasn't on fire. He said, number two, can you breathe? And that's not like, is there any air, but is there like a release of ammonia that's going to kill you in there? So can you breathe?
Yeah.
And then three, are my ears popping, like rapid depressurization? He goes, any of those things signify immediate evac. And he goes, when I went through all those and realized it wasn't those and we had to go figure out what it was, he goes, that's when all my other people that were on ISS started floating over to me and they're like, what the hell did you do? But nice.
Yeah, that would be pretty horrifying with lots of alarms going off in a space station.
Yeah. From there, we went and saw, went out to the pad to go see the Falcon 9 rocket about 6 hours before liftoff. We were out there for about 25 minutes. They were shuttling us in and out as fast as they could. But he jumped on the bus and he's like, You guys have more questions? And my hand popped up right away. I just had a ton of questions for him. So it was great. We then came back and that's when we went to the VAB. We went out to the crawler to saw the massive 9 million pound crawler that has to lift 12 to 18 million pounds.
Yeah, that thing is gigantic. We went out to see the crawler on day two. And I think the highlights of the trip for me were the VAB and the crawler. Like, we went out to see the rocket on day two and it's a rocket, right? And I was like, wow, that's really cool. We're pretty close to that rocket and that's about to go up into space tonight. But for me, it was like, I just don't know. It was, the crawler was just like absolutely incredible and the VAB were absolutely incredible. And yeah, the rocket to me was like, hey, yeah, it's a rocket. The crawler was amazing, huge machine. It was built in the 60s and there's only two of them in the world. It's modeled off an old piece of mining machinery, or parts of it are at least anyway. And it rolls on these crawlerways, they call them, right? They're made of river rock, and the thing just crushes it behind it. Like, it's so heavy, it turns these rocks to sand, you know. And they were doing testing with it.
That blew my mind.
So it had a whole bunch of upgrades for the SLS launch system, or SLS rocket system, and they were testing them out. I mean, this thing auto levels with 18 million pounds on top of it. It can crawl up a incline up to the pads. It's an electric vehicle. It's got generators on board that generate the electricity, which burn diesel. But they're testing out a bunch of upgrades on it. And so they headed out of the VAB and we got to talk to the engineers and stuff and got shown around it. And then they all jumped on board and fired it up and started off down the crawlerway. And if you've ever seen that episode out of Austin Powers, you know, he's about to get rolled over by that roller or whatever and flattened. But the thing's moving so slowly, like, it was incredible. It was going like 1 mile an hour.
So we asked him, we asked our guy, we're like, so have you ever taken anything and shoved it under one of the wheels to see what it does? And he's like, oh yeah. He goes, you know, put a Coke can underneath there and did it. He goes, but there's a famous story about another one that we did. He goes, we actually had it was already dead. He said, but we got a raccoon and we put a raccoon under it and drove over it. And it was like, what in the world was that like? And he's like, not going to go into details, but let's just say it was the flattest raccoon you have ever seen.
Oh my goodness. Yeah,
the thing that blew me away about that thing is that I didn't realize when he kept saying lift, I was like, what are you lifting? What do you have to lift? First of all, when they drive up to the launch complex, either 39A or B, there's a big ramp to go up it. And it can't just go up the ramp. It's got to keep the platform level within 2 degrees because otherwise the rocket's going to tip over, fall back. That's a big mistake.
Big boo-boo.
Yeah, big boo-boo. So instead, what they did was it self-levels. And so the two ends can lift themselves independently up to 6 feet. So it, for SLS, what it's going to do is it's going to drive underneath what's called the mobile launch platform, where SLS is going to get stacked. it will then lift, it'll duck under it, go over, and it's kind of like when you were a kid, when you'd walk under a table, scooched over, and then put your back on the bottom of the table and then stand up to lift it. That's what it's going to do. But yeah, I asked him, you know, so how in the world do you do, how do you test lifting something 12 to 18 million pounds? He's like, yeah, we had one guy say, we have these giant, you know, water things that we use to test the cranes to get them certified every 6 months in the VAB. They weigh like 700,000 pounds. And he's like, someone's like, yeah, let's use this. And he goes, I need another like 60 or 70 of them.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't really test for that. That's, there must be somehow they do it, but yeah, that's, yeah, you don't have sort of 18 million pounds lying around.
It's all, he said it was all modeling. He said, it's all just, we don't know, but it's all done on the computer, and it knows everything about the crawler, and it can tell if the crawler can support it or not. And but we really won't know until we actually go to lift it up the first time.
Yeah, that's cool. What else was there? Highlights. Booster stacking. So we went to, yeah, we'll talk about SwampWorks in a sec, but
so much.
Yeah, there's so many things to talk about. We may have to geek out again.
Yeah.
But one of the spots I went to was Booster Fabrication Facility. At least I think that's what it was called. It's where they... So, you know, on the side of the shuttle, they've got the two solid rocket boosters. It's where they put those together. And this was another building on Kennedy. They're using those same rocket boosters, except slightly longer versions for the SLS system. And so we got to see them putting boosters together. These were inert boosters, not ones with solid rocket fuel in them, but with a rubber material that was similar to the density and weight of the solid fuel that would normally be in there, because they were testing the lifts and all that sort of stuff. This building hasn't been used since shuttle, and for the most part, it's the same. And they were training people or retraining people, as well as training new people to learn how to stack these boosters and put them together. And that was pretty cool. Like, we saw, you know, lifting going on. It's the first time the public had been in there in a number of years, and seeing them put these boosters together. And the size of these things is just phenomenal. And there's basically a nuclear explosion that gets blasted out of the end of them and propels previous years the shuttle, but in coming years the SLS, and to get away from Earth's gravity. So this thing was very cool. Just being so close to these segments and up close and personal, they're humongous. Like, it just boggled my mind.
Yeah, I didn't get to see that. We both did do something else. We went to a place called SwampWorks, which we don't want the show to go on too long. So we're gonna pump this, but SwampWorks, just in brief passing, that was essentially like the crazy R&D. CJ and I both saw some really cool stuff. Just if you're interested in learning more about it, I am writing a blog post, a really long blog post on my experience with the NASA Social. So if you're interested, we'll update the show notes, but it's going to be out after the episode goes live. So just watch my blog over the next week or two, and I'll detail a lot of the stuff that I saw. Can't show you any pictures of it because we weren't allowed to take our cameras or phones in the building. But it was like, think SwampWorks, think like Skunkworks, where you would build like the really crazy airplanes, and like the SR-71 was what came out of a place called Skunkworks. This is called SwampWorks because it's built on a swamp. So really cool stuff.
Lots of interesting experiments and things they may need in the future. The only thing I'll say about this is the building. So the building is from Apollo days, where the astronauts trained in the lunar lander simulator. And so I'm sitting there in this building looking at the walls, and there's these photos of these old astronauts, many that have passed away now, that are training for the Apollo missions, and it's just blown away at the history there. It was incredible. Anyway, why don't we get to the meat and the potatoes of your visit, which was the press conference after the launch.
Yeah.
I guess we should mention the launch. We both went out to the causeway and watched the launch. Mine was a night launch, which was just breathtaking. I'd been to a day launch for the last shuttle, STS-135. That was a much bigger rocket, so it made a much bigger butter boom. It was really cool watching it from the causeway and at night. Place looked lit up like the sun was out. It was impressive.
Yeah, mine was about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Same causeway, within 2 miles of the launch area. You're so close that as you're getting off the bus, my guide was saying, look, if this rocket goes boom in a way it's not supposed to go boom, he said, leave your stuff. I'm going to yell for everybody to get on the bus. And you've got about 10 seconds to get on the bus because the bus is leaving with or without you, because the gases that come off of this thing could kill you in a second if you breathe them in. He said, so we're getting the hell out of here. You leave everything if we yell. If it explodes, don't stop and take pictures. There'll be plenty of pictures on TV. Get the hell out of here.
We had the same safety briefing, obviously.
But from there, one of the things that was really unique about mine is that I was on my launch. I didn't get to see it happen because it was a couple hundred miles out to sea. But SpaceX was able to land the first stage of the rocket that I saw blast off on the barge. Plenty of things covered that. It was really slick. I'll also put a link to the video of a guy who had a telescope that actually tracked our launch. It was really slick. He actually is a neuroscientist, crazy telescope, and he wrote the software to actually lock onto the rocket and follow it up.
That's cool. But the barge landing was spectacular. I was in the office back at work, and we were all gathered around the screen watching it. And I was whooping and hollering and shouting and screaming. And when they nailed it, I just like, very, very happy.
I have my iPad streaming the webcast, and half the people went over to the guy with the telescope to look at his recording, and half the people came over to me, and we just all started going nuts when he landed. It was so cool. So from there, we went back, got on the bus, and they asked everybody. I know you had this opportunity too, but no one really took it up because your post-launch mission briefing was, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning or something? Yours was super late.
Exactly, yeah, it was super late.
So mine was at about 6 o'clock, about an hour after the launch. And so we went to go do it. I duck into the restroom to go take a leak real quick before we went in there. And I come out of the restroom, and I almost got just run over by Elon Musk. I come out of the restroom, and I just like go, whoa, who was that? Elon just goes right on by, go back to the annex, and someone's like, hey, we can all go into the post-mission briefing. So we got to go into the press conference. And got to watch the entire press conference, which you can watch on YouTube, and watch Elon answer all the questions about stuff. You said, I haven't seen it yet. You said you could see us on TV.
I think I briefly caught you in the background of one of the shots, yeah.
You can definitely see my shirt and my jeans a bunch. I don't think you could, I was at the very back of the room, but Elon was just, it was a freaking riot. Like, I mean, someone asked him about the next thing they're going to do about trying to land the Falcon Heavy and all three rockets coming back. And he talked about how it was going to be significantly harder with a significantly higher pucker factor.
I know, I heard that and I lost it. It was pretty funny.
Oh, and then his other quote that was, it was hilarious. Somebody asked him, so now what do you do now that you've landed it on the barge? How do you get it back? And he's like, well, we're kind of like the dog that caught the bus. We're trying to figure it out right now.
It was pretty good, actually. Like, oh, we caught the bus. Like, what do we do now?
Yeah. But you know what's so cool about this? And I will say this before we wrap this up. It's really important. Why is this such a big deal? So I did the math based on what Elon said. So let's just, and I took a liberty of one thing. So there's four parts of the rocket when SpaceX does a launch, right? There's the first stage, which is the one that gets you up into the upper atmosphere to really get the thing going. There's the second stage, which is going to take it to the actual like orbital velocity and deliver the whatever the payload is. In this case, it was Dragon. Other times it's satellites. There's the nose cone on the very top of the rocket, and then there's the fuel. So the second stage is not intended to be brought home. It burns up on the way back in the atmosphere. It's just not, relatively speaking, it's one of the cheapest parts of the rocket. The nose cone is $2 million. That's the next thing they want to try and get back. The Dragon is already reusable. They're already, when they send that up, it's either satellites being left up there intentionally, or it's Dragon, which they have already been able to recover that in the past. So the thing is to get, how do we get this first stage back? That first stage costs $60 million to build today. The fuel is $200,000 to $300,000. However you're going to use that, that's going to happen on every launch. So you're going to spend $60 million on it. Now, Elon said in the press conference that this thing could be reused 10 to 20 times, right? And he said with a little bit of refurb, once we get it back, we can even, the lifespan could be even 100 times. But let's go on the low end. 10 times, right? Because all those other numbers even make it's even more impressive. If you bought 10 of those to send them up, that means you're spending $600 million to put this thing up. If instead you spend $60 million on the first one, let's say it's going to cost $2 to $3 million on the recovery effort. As Elon said, hose it down, give it a good wash.
I'm sure it involves a little bit more than that, but yeah.
Yeah. You see that in the press conference where he's like, yeah, hose it down, give it a good wash.
I was waiting for it and a fresh coat of paint.
Yeah. So let's say it's going to cost $2 to $3 million to recover the rocket from on the drone ship or on land, then to go through and clean it up, to do any kind of refurb. They're going to fire the engines 10 times to make sure it still works and then send it back up. So instead of spending $600 million, the math is going to be $60 million plus 9 times 3 million, the high end of that one, right? Because you don't need to do this to the 10th one. The 10th one, let's just say, is expendable.
Yeah, they're going to burn it up.
Yeah, that takes a launch from $60 million that first stage down to $8.7 million. That's a savings of 85% of a cost savings. You imagine someone going around with a satellite they spend $100 million on. They're looking at all the different options to go through and to put it out, to put something up in orbit. They're looking at the different options in SpaceX, like, well, we're like 85%. I mean, they're already the cheapest game in town compared to Orbital and Sierra Nevada and the ULA. You imagine they're going, yeah, we're another 85% cheaper. That just is so significant, because that's what the thing that holds us back from space is, it's so damn expensive.
Yeah.
And this is a significant way to reduce costs so we can do it even more. So that's, I think that, to me, that's what's so cool about that. That's why this is such a big deal.
Yeah. It's going to take a while for, you know, for them to get there, but it's the absolute, it's the only way forward.
He said that this one should go up in the next 3 months.
Yeah.
He said this one should go up in the next 3 months. And the SES, the company SES over in Europe that's putting up another satellite, they've already said that they're interested in using a refurb rocket.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, so this is a big deal.
This is a big deal for them, right? They've got to get this right for their whole sort of viability thing to come to fruition. His whole game is reusability. That's why they're doing all of this, return to the base and also return to a barge. Or ship, I should say. And
good joke in there. Good joke in there. Yeah. He hates it being called a barge.
Right. So yeah, I mean, it all hinges on reusability. So I'm very much looking forward to seeing the first reused first stage go back up.
So we can't talk about everything in this episode. We went through as much stuff as we could cover, but there's things like Swamp Works and some other stuff that we didn't get a chance to talk about. So it was a lot of fun. If you're interested in hearing more about this topic here, please reach out to us. Let us know. Leave a comment on our site. Mention something on Twitter. We'd love to have a 5-star review too on iTunes as well. It helps other people find the show. But we do want to hear from you and find out if this was something that you found interesting, if you liked, and maybe we can do more of these episodes in the future. I mean, I know I'd love to go into more detail and explain the stuff that we saw at Swamp Works and some of the cool science stuff going on there.
Yeah, there's definitely like Swamp Works we could go into in great detail. I went to the ULA facility where they put all the rockets together. We totally didn't talk about any of that stuff. There's tons we could go into on this. So even just reaching out to us on Twitter and saying hi would be awesome. All right. Well, thanks a lot, AC. I hope everybody's got something out of this and that we didn't completely bore you to death. We know it's not one of our normal shows, so we're not going to do this all the time, but from time to time, we're going to pick interesting topics and dive in. But we'll be back to our regular programming next week.
If you have a question for us, go to microsoftcloudshow.com/questions, where you can submit it as text or record it as a WAV or MP3 and provide a link so we can play your question on the show. You can subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Microsoft Cloud Show or via RSS at microsoftcloudshow.com, where you'll also find a full transcript and show notes of each episode. You can also find us on Facebook searching for Microsoft Cloud Show or on Twitter at MS Cloud Show. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.